The Oddcast.
Two guys yelling at each other about radio, music, and nonsense. And now, here's Max Tolkoff and Halloran.
Ready? I'm going to start mine at the same time as you start yours. Ready? On your marks, get set, go. Ladies and gentlemen, Max Tolkoff.
Are we rolling?
Yes, we better be rolling because started already. We started their
recording.
Are we starting?
Are you sure?
They got the reel to reel is going in the other room.
All right.
At this point.
You do the intro this week.
The intro this week is brought to you by Plants. Plants in the other room. We have no sponsor yet. Did you know that?
I'm just saying do the intro.
Doing the intro. The intro is...
How about this? One week, you do the intro. The next week, I'll do. We rotate. We'll rotate the intro. You do one,
I'm doing it right now.
You do it now.
You just interrupted my intro.
Well, you interrupted my intro last week.
Well, sorry. Welcome to the Oddcast. Are we going to call it the Oddcast? I think it's a great name.
If you wish.
Because we technically are the odd couple.
But I think it's like the Oddcast, and the subhead is two guys yell at each other about radio and music.
And things to do with radio and music, which we can also find.
Isn't that encompassed in the...
Why do you keep touching the microphone volume? Are the headphone volume? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Right. I'm fine.
Just relax.
I'm fine.
Relax.
I'm relaxed. I'm very relaxed.
Don't Last week's relaxed? Show, by the way, we got into some serious discussion about things that we didn't get to complete.
Okay. Take us back in time.
Which was protest songs. And I thought you'd had a week to think about it.
I
wanted to start with the concept of where did all the good protest songs go? Because I did a lot of research last week, and we barely grazed upon protest songs.
I didn't do any research. I essentially I saw another episode of Punk, and I went, all right, I see where we're headed here.
Okay, let's go back.
This is the one genre of protest that stayed with us since the 70s.
Punk.
Yeah. No?
Well, yeah, technically.
Look, you know more about music than I do. I'm not an expert in any way, shape, or form.
Okay.
You're the genius.
Tell me, I have not, you saw Epix, right? E-P-I-X?
Epics.
Epics?
Epics,
it's not Epix?
Yeah,
is it a biopic or a biopic?
I call it a biopic.
You call it a biopic because it's a, I don't know, it could go both ways.
It could go both ways.
Epix or Epics?
I think it's Epics.
Okay. So you watched the first episode, which had on it some of the originators of the, and I will say it was the second wave of punk because they pretty much stole everything from Stooges. That's why John Varvatos was obviously on there, but Stooges, MC5, mm-hmm. and the early garage rock stuff,
right.
That amazing band from South America, whose name I'm spacing on right now.
I watched the second episode, too.
Okay, so tell me about the first episode. What did you glean from the second episode? The first episode.
The first episode was how important Detroit was to the whole thing with MC5 and the Stooges and whatnot. And New York was not a big thing for punk until the Ramones came along in the 70s.
So they didn't consider the early New York Dolls type stuff?
Yeah, they did. They talked about the New York Dolls. Yes, they covered New York, but it was a lot of, hey, Detroit was very important in this whole thing. So
and how did they, I haven't seen it and I will see it. And in my head, I know what it was, but mm-hmm. how did Detroit come into its own according to these people? Who was on the show, by the way? There was obviously John Varvatos is there.
Yeah. But the
Johnny
first
Rotten.
Week they talked to, they talked to Johnny Rotten, Iggy Pop, whoever the surviving Ramone is.
Marky.
Yeah. They talked to Marky. They talked to.
Not the original.
They talked to a bunch of people, you know, Debbie Harry's on there, a lot of people from bands that I'd never even heard of were on there, and they're all like freaking 8,000 years old now.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'll have to watch it then, because if they're 8,000 years old.
Oh, you got to watch it. I can't believe you haven't seen the first episode.
I don't think I have a
it's
subscription
so
to Epics.
It's like the Halloran Show.
Okay.
Epics.
So tell me, what did you learn? What did you glean from this as far as, was it protesty at the time?
No. What I gleaned was that at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s, there were a lot of people who were just pissed off, and it wasn't the protest music of the early, mid, late 60s.
Right.
And suddenly punk was sort of like, okay, this is the protest music of now, the late 70s, mid 70s, late 70s, and then on.
Full of anger.
Yes.
Full of what is going on in this country. What yes. about the CSNY thing with what year was
that was all 67, 68, 69, you know, what year
was Kent State?
Kent State was 1970.
That was 70?
Yeah, it was 1970.
Wow. So Stooges earlier than that.
Yes.
So one of the first protest songs that got on the radio.
But it didn't really, it wasn't like a national movement. It was sort of like, okay, here's all this, you know, here's Iggy and the Stooges in Detroit. Here's MC5 in Detroit. And they're all playing a bunch of gigs and it was terrible and awful, you know, sound and awful venues. And it was all sort of localized. There was no big, in fact, in the first episode, they talk a lot about how punk wasn't even a name that they were using for that kind of music.
No.
It was only after the magazine called punk that it sort of then gravitated to the bands. And there was a newspaper magazine called punk.
Right.
All of which you know.
I have not seen the thing because I know what I know. Because
I can't wait till they get to the episode where you're credited with creating the Beastie Boys. That's what I'm waiting for. Did they not talk to you about this? Were you not contacted by this show?
Why would they contact me? I was the guy that came along. Extreme. I mean, some of my earliest interviews were because Don was, who is older than myself, was tight with Wayne Kramer, and he brought Wayne Kramer by my radio show back in the late 70s, early 80s in Detroit after he had done his prison time.
Right.
And I met John Sinclair through those guys, the guys who were basically the, you know, the latter-day hippie generation of the weed bash or whatever it was called in Ann Arbor, all those kind of things. But I was a kid. I was in 1969, I was 10.
Were you 10?
I was 10 in 69. Yeah. So I was not hip to the things. I became hip to it as I was going to school in England and the things started being not necessarily released in England, but, you know, when the Pistols and all that stuff happened, and it was all basically, you know, back to the Detroit curation of it. And I started getting into it at that point because I know people. I worked at this company called Producers Color Service at one point in my weird career of the film world. And I got my own weird radio show on DET. I'd beg them, you know, scream, cajole them, and I got this 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. time slot and played all the weird music I could possibly find. But one of the guys I worked with at Producers Color Service, a guy called Vince Capizio,
Capizio of the Shoes, I believe.
He could have named that. So, but Vince, who was one of the sound engineers at Producers Color Service, he was in charge of Wayne State University, and they had some sort of a video department. Back in the days of, did they show the footage of the MC5 playing on Tartar Field?
I don't know if it was Tartar Field. There was a lot of great footage.
But it was out in the open. That was shot by Vince and his crew. But to get the band, to allow the band to be able to go shoot that thing, they had to go in front of the Board of Regents and basically audition. So I remember seeing this early version of whatever videotape was back in those days. And this guy was, I don't know how to describe it, but he basically was like a whole bunch of people in suits at a university, and the MC5 basically had to play in front of them to say, this is what we're going to do out in your field. And it was just weird. I mean, could you imagine if rock bands would come into a music director and they'd set up and go, okay, here's the song we wanted you to play on the radio, and then they rip into this thing and somebody goes, oh, that's wonderful. I'm giving them an English accent because they're on the Board of Regents, and you have to think that they must be very regent. They must be very regent to do this.
Board of Regents.
And I remember Vince showing this to me, and I was just freaking gobsmacked that this was part of the process that they had to go through. From that, because you've got to remember, none of this stuff was like released. There was no YouTube back in those days. In fact, I don't think there was even black and white television.
There was no radio that any of this stuff could show up on. I don't even think there was.
There was at one point in Detroit super underground radio shows on ABX and things like that, but not
AM or FM. What year?
FM.
FM.
They probably started. I'd have to call somebody, but ABX went freeform at one point, probably 67, 68, maybe. I could look that up while you're cajoling me about something else. Let me.
Go ahead. Look it up. We have the internet here. We've got phones.
So you tell me what. You tell me what else happened to that thing while I look this up.
What, punk? I can't. I'm not going to review it except that it's great because it's, especially if you don't know, I didn't know about all of this at that time. You know, I was busy, by the way, in the mid-70s to late 70s, I was on working on Madison Avenue. And what, I didn't what? Go. I went down to CBGB's maybe once or twice, but I was not aware of all this stuff at the time.
It's 1960, May 4th, 1960.
Which
it
was what?
It was beginning as classical music and adopted an MOR format, middle of the road in 64.
Which station was that?
ABX.
Oh, ABX.
99.5, the one we went to try to take over years ago.
Yeah.
And for a short period beginning in 67, station adopted an all-girl jock policy during the day. It was playing jazz-oriented pop music and humorous bits. That was 67.
Wow.
And then Mickey Shore, who was the program manager and creative director of Century Broadcasting, who ended up opening up a whole bunch of car stereo shops later. He was working for Century at the time. And then they started a new music show called The Troubadour from 7 to 8 in the evenings. And then the Troubadour thing started taking off. And February 1st, 68, playlists were acceptable. They all went out. The DJs picked their own music. So Feb 1st, 68, which would have been the onslaught of the Five and the Stooges in that era. And they started doing hippy-dippy-trippy stuff.
When you were growing up and you were first listening to radio, right, you took a radio into the bedroom, you put it under the pillow and listened at night. Where were you? Was that Detroit?
England? It was in Detroit in the 60s. Yeah, it was Detroit.
Yeah.
And then I moved to England in 70. So there was 2 years of me getting a little bit of underground radio and flipping through the dial. Because you got to remember, you know, top 40 radio in Detroit at that time was CKLW, which was
Canadian.
It was a clear channel, the original term for clear channel signals, which was 100,000 watts AM.
Right.
It boomed. It was at 800. It boomed all the way across to like the Rockies. And one of the most influential stations, Bob Seger, actually wrote a song about the music director called Rosalie. About she's got the power, she's got the tower. She could basically make your song a hit or make it not a hit. She was the one that broke
that was about radio. I had no idea.
Yeah, she broke the band called the Captain and Tennille. They were driving around in their crazy little van.
Where's Bob Seger from? Was he Detroit?
He's from Detroit. He's a Detroit guy. He started his deal in Detroit.
That's funny because I only remember him from when I was doing AOR in Denver, and we had to play "Get Out of Denver" 1,000 times a minute. So I thought he was from
Denver. Thank God you weren't working in Kathmandu. That's all I can say about that. But no, to your point, Bob was undergroundish hippie type stuff. But his early music, 2 + 2 is on my mind. It was about the Vietnam War. So there's a lot of conscientious stuff going on in those days.
I
haven't seen the epics, whatever the hell it is.
Epics, so, just say epics.
Okay, I haven't
it's
seen
not
epics.
Epics. Just say
on,
epics.
What label is it on? Is it on Epics?
It's on Epics.
Is it on Epics label?
Epics.
Okay.
Not Epic.
So, and I don't know. So I suppose what I'm trying to drive at. Did anybody bring up the fact that the dudes who had, because at that time the factories had been going since, you know, Henry Ford started cranking things out. So in the 60s, it was a lot of automation that was going on, these big stamping plants where they were taking these, you know, these.
Yeah, they were talking about how, like, even in the mid to late 60s, Detroit was starting to lose its shit. It was starting to get a little bit degenerate. People were leaving, you know, car plants closing, even as early as the late 60s.
There was always issues. I'm trying to remember, you know, when I first started noticing that Detroit was having its issues was probably when I think it was my parents were talking about, I can't believe anybody would buy a foreign car in Detroit because it was like ridiculous, you know. So somebody in the neighborhood bought a Jag. It was like, what's going on here?
Weren't they murdered for having a Jag? At that point, if you bought a non-American car,
weren't you 10 years later in the 70s and the 80s, my girlfriend at the time bought a Toyota Celica or Celica. I don't know how to pronounce it.
What is with you in pronunciations today?
Toyota.
I'm watching Epics, and I had a Celica, and my other car was a Volvo.
So Jody bought a Celica, and the car, we went to play a gig someplace, and the car got egged at a bowling alley that we were playing at. The guy went out and spent like a whole whatever. What was it for a dozen eggs back in those days?
I have no idea.
$1.69. The guy went out and spent a whole $1.69 on eggs to basically egg her car.
Don't forget, you were 10, but I was like 12.
No. I'm talking about, you know, a year later.
Oh, a year later.
Anybody who bought a
car. So you were 11, and I was 13.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
So the reason I'm asking all these questions is because we got to go back to the whole concept of the protest songs. And the MC5 obviously played in 68.
But here's what I want to get to. It's not so much, let's do the history of the we know kind of what it is. Here's what we should be talking about is there's obviously a lot of anger today. Where's the angry music that is sort of, you know, where is our Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young of today? The protest music of today.
Okay.
Ohio, you know, the man, anti-war. And you were talking about how, yes, rap is our protest
hip-hop.
Music.
It's called hip-hop. Hip-hop.
Rap, hip-hop, whatever. Beyond that, though, where's the next generation
there's a few
of
bands,
angry people making music?
There's a few bands out there, but what we honed in upon last time was the fact that in those days, before the corporatization of any of this media stuff, because Century Broadcasting or whatever it was back in those days, they were only allowed to own, what, a total of 7 across the whole country, right?
No, it was 12 AMs and 12 FMs.
Was it?
Yeah, 12.
Okay, well, if it's 12 right? and 12.
It's 12 and 12.
40?
No.
They can own 40 across the country. No.
No.
ABC.
You've got to own I'm not talking 12 about AMs and 12 FMs. That's all you got to own.
Look, Alex is going to look it up in the other room. In the day, I think it was a total of like 7 AM. So 14. It was a total of 14.
I think it was 12.
I was giving you early
90s. No. I'm talking about the 60s before everything went crazy. As much as I love you, fuck off. So the point is that they couldn't have an overreaching influence across the whole country. The O&O stations, the owned and operated stations, I think was a total of 7 AM and 7 FM in those days because ABC owned KLOS. Did they own one in Denver?
Not that I remember.
They owned ABC in New York,
yeah,
right?
It was, New York, Chicago, Dallas.
Detroit. Riff in Detroit. Dallas, I think.
Yeah,
San Francisco, probably.
San Francisco, L.A.
So their biggest influence could be upon 7 markets total. So if they all said, we're going to play.
Yeah, but it didn't go. I mean, corporately, it wasn't.
This is what I'm saying.
But weren't even rocks. I mean, PLJ, which was the ABC owned in New York, that was not like a freeform station. Even in the early 70s, it was a very tight AOR. And in fact, later on, they kind of almost stepped into the Rock 40. Remember Rock 40? It was like Top 40, but it was more rocky.
I don't even want to think about that.
Yeah, so PLJ kind of went into that direction.
At one point in this crazy podcast world, we're going to have to basically fly Steve Leeds out because he's the knowledgeable man that remembers everything about New York radio because he knows where it all started, how it happened.
Yeah,
and he's the guy that would basically say that here's where the protest music started and here's where it stopped. But there were protest songs that we didn't even know were kind of protest songs that were getting played on radio.
But so, yes, and even now there are protests, but they're few and far between. There's no general movement of anger. Stop that. There's no general movement of anger. Where's the general movement
it's there.
Of anger?
It's there. The problem is,
it's sort of like, okay, wait, here we go. So at the end of the 80s, alternative was The Cure, Depeche Mode, Susie and the Banshees. 1993, after all that, you know, syntho nonsense that everybody hated, along comes Nirvana.
It's 91,
92, but Smells Like Teen Spirit was the big breakout. Okay, that's the one that sent us into the next generation of grunge. Not necessarily protest. Angry Youth of America, yes, but not necessarily protest. Is grunge our next turning point for music? At that point, the early 90s.
There were songs in that era that still got played because nobody was going to question what the lyrics were about.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So people were going to still play them. But once the claws were set in with what iHeart became eventually.
You mean Clear Channel?
Well, now it's iHeart.
Yeah, it's iHeart. I still call it Clear Channel.
It was Clear Channel. Started as J-Core. I remember J-Core, when.
Right. All of this. It was like the bigger fish ate the smaller fish until finally there was only one big fish left.
And what ended up happening was at that point they were nationalizing some of the playlists. They did it first of all, I think, with country, and then they started doing it with rock. And to me, the most distinctive time was after September 11th, which wasn't that long ago. It's a long time ago, but it wasn't that
longer, but it's not that long.
It's not that long ago. That's when suddenly that list came out from somebody in one of those organizations.
Right, but, okay. So before that, then in the '90s, let's say grunge took over for a while. We want to give it 8 years before people got fed up with that. Then we had 9/11. Musically, it's hard to say where we went after that.
We went, well, this...
I don't know. I can't even think of the aughts.
Scary memory that I have, I do distinctly remember there was an era of when it went from the Pure Seven, as somebody, I think it's Ted Volk that calls it the Pure Seven, which was K-Rock, Live 105, 91X.
Who said the Pure Seven? What?
The original seven alternative stations across the country, the ones that basically controlled the whole playlist before Nirvana became...
I don't recall any stations controlling a national playlist.
Open your mind a little bit. The chart was made up of not many radio stations. So if I was playing something...
The chart?
The chart... Listen, the chart was basically...
The chart was 20 stations.
Before that, what was the original seven?
There was
seven?
No chart. Okay. There were no seven. If you want to talk about what? DRE?
DRE.
91X. The Quake.
Hold on. DRE, 91X. Live 105. K-Rock.
Well, before Live 105, before there was a chart, it was
Dallas?
Dallas was Edge. The Edge in Dallas.
And then
there was
two more.
The Edge in
Chicago.
Dallas was, Q101?
And then one more. I'll have to ask Ted Volk. I should just call him on the phone and go, what were the Pure Seven? The original, he had this term.
Are you thinking of the Six Sisters that were all owned by Infinity? Infinity owned New York.
See, Alex
and
is,
LA
Alex
and
is gonna
San
keep
Francisco.
Doing this. He's making, but my point is that what? Those were the ones. So if a band came out and they got them on that, they could chart the record pretty easily. Otherwise, it was a regional thing where something would pop up in San Diego, something would pop up in San Francisco, and we could pay attention to that stuff. Because when you started playing certain bands like the Wire Trains of the world, where did you get that information from?
Wire Train, Chamber of Hellos?
Anything like that.
Yeah, it was the early 80s. It was just sort of, it came in the door. It was already there.
But how did you find out about it? Just
I don't
because
know.
Howie just, Klein called you up and said, hey.
No, at that point, you got to understand, at that point, nobody was calling us. Nobody had an alternative promotion department. So if they were going to work to radio, they would get these AOR guys who already were calling KLOS and the AOR stations, KGB, and then they made them call the alternative stations. They didn't know anything about the music.
So you're saying that your Epic guy who called you?
The Epic guy was based in Phoenix. His name was Joe Bravo. Great guy.
And this is the guy that worked you on early Clash records?
No. He didn't work us on anything until Till Tuesday came out. Till Tuesday was the thing on Epic that Epic worked at Alternative Radio.
That was the first Epic record you got worked.
That's the first one that I remember in San Diego.
What's the first time you remember somebody from Warner Brothers coming and talking to you about one of their bands?
That was Steve Tipp, also in the early 80s, and he was doing club promotion. He wasn't even doing alternative promotion. He was doing club promotion.
And that's before he went to New York to go to CBS and then come back.
Yeah, I mean, he actually brought in the first... We played Madonna at 91X before anybody else did.
She was alternative at the time.
Yeah, she was a club act.
We played her in Detroit because she was from Detroit. That was our whole deal was, hey, there's this young lady from Detroit who used to hang out at the Menjo's, the gay bar next to the punk bar. And she moved to New York and made waves, and dance music was the norm back then.
Yeah, so we weren't worked by a lot of normal promotion people. It was dance clubs, it was dance promotion, or college, the college people took a run at us. Nobody knew how to deal with these stations. That was the funniest
thing. You weren't dealing with the Kim Whites of the world at Celluloid, when Kim was working at Celluloid Records.
Yeah, maybe. I don't remember. But
she was
possibly
working me on things like Golden Palominos. All the bands that were on Saturday.
When you were in Detroit?
Because she was originally from LA. She moved to New York, and she and I believe Jordy Gillespie at that time, I think.
Listen,
he was.
You gotta understand, I don't know if you remember this, but we used to, in the early years of 91X, we would have 2 to 3 music meetings a week. There was so much music, we couldn't do it all in one meeting. We'd have 3 meetings a week to find music.
Take me through one of those.
one of those meetings.
It was me,
Jim Gelero.
Paul Sansone. Once you took it over, I'm not talking about the early days when Jim Gelero ran it for what, a year total.
Yeah. He was the PD and I was the MD.
So you had three when you were the MD?
Yes. Yes.
Take me through one of them. What did you do? I got a bunch of imports in. Let's go play this. Give me a standout.
There wasn't a lot of like regular service from major labels because they hadn't even discovered the format yet. So there wasn't a lot of music on major labels. It's all like independent labels and imports. Yeah. There was always like, you know, somebody brought in the original 12-inch mix of Blue Monday from New Order. It was like the 8-minute original vinyl mix.
Right.
And the first time we heard it, we went to the music meeting in the conference room at 91X, big long table after work. And somebody put that record on, and it was so good. We just let it just play. We kept playing it, and it was sort of like the background to the discussions we were having. Then we'd play all this other music. And it was all mostly imports back then. It was a lot of imports.
So do you remember who walked that 12-inch in?
I don't remember. I think it might have been Sal Paradise, Paul Sansone. Right. Who had a specialty show on Sundays. So I think he walked it in.
With Mark Geiger.
Maybe. But then there were a lot of kids that were like, hey, listen to this. And they went out and they went through stores
don't
in
be
San
vague.
Diego.
What? Some kids. When you say some kids, who are these kids?
Who knows? Kevin Stapleford, a bunch of other people. People that were like interns.
Right.
And other
Pam.
Various. Pam, when she showed up eventually. But there was the pre-Pam years.
Oh, so Pam wasn't there in 83?
Not right away.
84? When did she get there?
It might have been 84. I'm...
Memory is foggy.
My memory is failing me.
RAM is almost full.
Yeah.
Give me the other standouts. Do you remember the first time you heard Teenage Enema Nurses in Bondage? Was that a record that Rick sent down?
Yeah. So there was a lot of records that came from K-Rock that were like, what the heck?
How did
Are
that
we
work?
Play this?
Tell me how that worked. Did he come down weekly with a box or did he send you a box? Or
we would
did
get,
you send somebody up there to get a box?
No. How did it work? He would send some things down. He came down occasionally, not all that often. And he was never there when he would say he was going to be there. Like if he said, I'll be down like Wednesday. Right, he wouldn't show up till Friday, and the only reason we knew he was nearby is that we started to get a lot of phone calls looking for Rick. So when the phone calls started coming in, hey, where's Rick? We knew, all right, he must be close.
This is all pre-cell phones. People were calling K-Rock to talk to him. Right. Oh, he's on his way to San Diego
because he had to bring us the music wheels, the music keys.
Right, the keys.
It was pre-fax, even the clocks. So they would, I forget how they showed up down there, but they somehow did. We had to get the clocks every week because Ricky filled out the clocks at that point in time.
Hand done.
Hand wheels.
It's like when KCRW talks about hand-picked playlists, hand-picked music.
Yes.
Rick Carroll was the one picking it for us. There was no computer. He hand-picked it. Was he doing it from a card box?
Yeah,
or memory.
I think he was doing. I don't know what he was doing up there. I mean, first of all, we could get into a whole discussion about which records were legit and which ones were being pushed by people that might have been only turntable hits.
Let me ask you a question then. So, if nobody was working people on records that you remember, then who would have been working Rick on Berlin, or who would have been working Rick on Wire Train, or whatever
question.
It was?
We don't know. I don't know. I think he talked to a couple of independent promoters. There were indies working. There were independent promoters at that time were fine. In the alternative format, nothing shady about that at all because nobody else was working this good music.
And there wasn't any grift.
No, there wasn't any of that. But there were like legitimate people who were into new bands, you know, independent labels, good music, and they were calling us.
Right.
The ones that... I shall not name names because this guy would get very pissed off. But there was this one guy that called when I became music director. And he would call, and with very little preamble, he'd go, hey, how you doing? This is blank. Listen, I need you to listen to the following records. And he would literally read a list of 15 songs and bands. Just list them. Not even like, right. Hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of this?
Did he live in San Diego?
No, he was in L.A. And... he would go, okay, listen to those songs. I'll call you next week. He did this a few times, and I was like, I'm not talking to this guy anymore. He doesn't know anything about the format, the music, nothing. All he's calling up and doing is reading a list of records he wants us to listen to and put in. So after a while, I stopped taking his call. And so after about 3 or 4 weeks of that, he understood he wasn't going to get through to me. So then his assistant called me. And she got on the phone and said, "Hi, so-and-so would like you to listen to the following 15 records." And then she would read the list of 15 records. And then I just stopped taking that call from those people altogether.
Right.
Because it wasn't about the format. It was just, I need
to get a list of things I'm quote-unquote working.
I'm working. And this was in the 80s. And but that was still rare. The good indies were good because they were talking about good music for the most part.
There was a case, I don't know if I brought this up fully last week, but there was a case of when Sandinista came out, there was a record that REO Speedwagon had out at the same time. And I don't remember exactly what thing they had out at the same time. It was whatever their album was at the same time. Sandinista, I think, was 1980, if I remember correctly. And one of the guys that did the radio show with me, who has since passed away, is a guy named Mike Marantic, had a day job at Harmony House, which was, they had probably 5 or 6 locations in southeastern Michigan. And they were like one of the major distributors. They distributed to a lot of the other record stores. And he was in charge of talking to the record label reps, because in those days, the record label rep would call up and say, "Okay, how many boxes did you sell of The Clash?" And Marantic would say, "I sold 5. And it was a triple album, right? And then you go, "How many of the REO Speedwagon?" "I sold 2. And then he would basically go through all these things, and then the guy would be writing all this information down, because what would happen is about 2 hours later, Riff, Wheels, W4, whoever's, they would call up and say, "Tell us what's selling." So the label guy basically told Marantic at one point, "Take all the boxes of The Clash and add it to REO Speedwagon, and I'll give you tickets to go see The Clash when they play in town." Oh. And of course, this guy doesn't understand what's happening, because nobody's ever saying we're manipulating the chart.
Right.
If Marantic had been truthful, and every other record store had been truthful of what is selling, The Clash might have actually gotten airplay from Sandinista on the radio in Detroit, but instead they were basically all playing a record that really wasn't selling, right, which was the REO Speedwagon record.
Isn't it amazing? Doesn't it blow your mind that, imagine what music we could have listened to if they weren't trying to shove shit down our throats.
But it was the manipulation thing that drove me insane, because once he told me that, I knew that the radio show that I was doing, Radios in mm-hmm. Motion, I was on the right track by playing bands like The Clash,
right,
and XTC and The Police.
Yeah.
And The Members and all these other crazy bands that we were playing in those days, and YouTube before anybody knew who they were, because I knew, I saw the shows, I could track the real sales because of guys like Marantic,
yeah,
and because of Dearborn Music and Off the Record. And the goal was just to get where the people were buying them, because in those days, there was no downloads, as we know. There was also no ticket bastard. So when you went to buy concert tickets, and I was either, you know, gifted tickets, or the label put me on the list, or the promoter put me on the list, I could walk in there and see, well, this place is full, as opposed to a band like Y&T. Remember that band Y&T?
Oh, yes.
Like I would, you know, I'd be like, "Why are we playing this shitty band?" And it's basically, well, the label priority. And after a while, you kind of realize that it's the manipulation of all those things that started driving me absolutely insane. And then I eventually left, and I came to work at a place called 91X in San Diego. And I met this guy. I have to tell you the story. I met this guy who I'd met years before. His name was Max Tolkoff. He looks a lot like you.
Mm.
And he was basically, I don't want to say he was set in his ways, but he had his...
How could I be set in my ways? I was like 28 years old.
You were 28 years old, but you were...
There's no way to be set in my ways.
You were set in your ways because...
No.
Yes.
No.
Because I'm telling you this. I'm gonna praise you in a minute, so calm the fuck down. You were set in your ways because there were things that I kind of knew regionally, because I'm going back to that same thing about the regional, you know, the regional takeoffs, like bands that would blow up, like the Stooges, yeah, the okay, MC5, and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And how bands blew up. Berlin was fucking huge in California. Oingo Boingo was huge in California. They couldn't get arrested in Detroit.
Right.
So when I arrived, I remember sitting down with you and going, Can we play this? Can we play this? And this is where the praise comes. You actually said to me, and we brought this up the other week, you actually said, "Yeah, go ahead and do an edit on Violent Femmes, add it up,
mm-hmm.
take the fucks out, mm-hmm. spin them around, whatever the fuck you want to do." And we started playing it pretty much as a current.
Yeah, yeah.
3 years after. I got there in 86. 3 years
after. When you would make a point about something, I'd listen to you. Okay.
But why? Why the fuck did you listen
to
an old,
you know, because Steve West, our good buddy Steve West from 91X, quick quick story. We needed our own English guy. Richard Blade was at K-Rock, right? So we're sitting down here in San Diego going, well, K-Rock's got this. They got personalities. They all have crazy names. And they got an English dude. And so at some point, we were sitting there going, well, you know, maybe we should get an English dude. We had no English dude. And then one day, I'm in the lobby, and this tall, lanky, crazy-haired, redheaded dude comes walking
in. Still
is
tall. Still is lanky.
And he's got headphones around his neck, and it's connected to a, you know, like a, what do you call it? Sony Walkman. Cassette. An old cassette. And he introduces himself, and he's British, and I go, oh, hey, great, you're from England, huh? Yeah, but I'm working up in San Clemente at this radio station. And I go, and he goes, do you need any air talent? Do you need any disc jockeys or anything? I go, well, you know, we're full, kind of full right now, but let me hear your, you know, leave me a tape. So he just pops the headphones that he's wearing onto my head, hits play on the cassette player, and I hear a couple of air checks, a couple of breaks from him. And as soon as it was over, I said, all right. When can you start? We need you. And I went back and I talked about it with Jim Gelero and John Lynch. We had a little conversation. Went, we need our own English guy. And here's this dude from San Clemente.
So
let's hire him.
Okay,
so we hired Steve West.
Pause for
Hang
one second.
Hang on, one quick thing.
So you're the reason that we need the wall.
Yeah, I am the
reason
we need
the
wall.
We have to build the wall to stop these fucking English people coming over here and taking over this format.
So Steve starts talking about, oh, this is big in England. We should play this. One of the songs, by the way, was Lamb Lies Down on Broadway from Genesis.
Which came out in 1975.
Yeah, which might have been great in England, but nobody in San Diego knew or cared.
Peter Gabriel had left the band years prior.
We had a lot of disagreements.
And he's bringing in, this
musically.
Is why I love Steve West.
But
he's bringing
you... You did not go that route. You were like, you're normal. So if you said, this band is important, I listened. We all listened to you. In fact, I should have made you the music director. Somebody else was in that position when you arrived.
Yeah, our good buddy Oz Medina, who brought some, to me, some of the most
amazing...
I'm not
going to say anything. I love Oz.
I do,
great,
too. I would not have understood anything about Cruzados. I would not have understood anything about the cool underground Southern California scene without, you know, his inclination in that world. Because he
But Oz is also old school. Like, I think he's older than us. I remember he wanted to add Tom Waits' Frank's Wild Years to the playlist.
And we should have.
You think we should have?
He's from San Diego. Tom Waits is, Tom Waits is the only reason that a Radiohead gets to exist, or anybody else that basically has some of the best storytelling on the planet.
Absolutely.
And Oz is right in that aspect. You should call him now.
Well,
I apologize to him for not playing.
We didn't.
What was
Oz's go-to when Oz would get pissed off and want to escape? And he did this a number of times when he was in radio. He's just like, I've had it. He'd go off and he'd go down to Mexico and sit on an island for a year. And then it'd be okay. And then he'd come back and rejoin society. And then he'd get pissed off and he'd leave again. But whenever he would sort of get fed up and leave, the thing that he would do is that he'd put Frank's Wild Years on and just leave the studio and go away. That's it. He would put it on. That would be the last song. And then he'd walk out. He didn't do it with us, but he told me he had done that a couple of times.
So he actually left his copy of Frank's Wild Years at the Quake in Dallas or wherever else he was working at the time.
Unbelievable.
I have mad respect for that guy. He's definitely done some unbelievably cool things when it comes to, you know, bringing a different vibe to the radio station. He was one of the first guys that basically was talking about how Johnny Cash should be part of everybody's regular rotation because he's more alternative than anybody else.
These were all arguments time that I didn't get. I didn't really understand that, okay? But later on, yes, okay? So now, if somebody were to allow us back at a radio station again, I would want to play all these important things that should have been played a long time ago. But because we had to get, like, look, all the songs that you recommended that I liked, I mean, I was a big Nick Lowe fan, Dave Edmonds, right?
Right.
All that rock pile stuff, Dave Edmonds, Nick Lowe, as we know, early influencers in this so-called format.
Right.
But when we did our very first music test, all of that stuff came back terrible. It was awful. And Fred Jacobs said to us, he said, look, I know you like this stuff and you think that it's important for the format, but look at the music test. You've got to, if you're going to buy into
the idea.
That's
why we love Fred Jacobs.
If you're going to buy into the idea of research.
If Fred Jacobs ruled the world, it would be there would be an Imagine Dragons 24-hour radio station on the air now.
I think that's unfair.
No, but I'm serious. We can basically whittle it down to which song from Imagine Dragons would be played at the top of the hour and which one would be on the bottom. You gotta understand
this. In the early days, Fred didn't care about the music. He was not knowledgeable about the music. He just wanted us to... He put the infrastructure in place and said, right. Look, if you're going to have a song, it's got to be in this category, and these songs have to populate this category, and the categories have to be consistent, and they all have to be with the same music, or else none of this works.
Right.
And I understood that. I bought into that. And so his thing was, look, if you're going to say, all right, I accept research, and you're going to spend $25,000 on a music test, you're pretty much bound. You have to sort of, you know, you're laying that kind of money out. You want to know what you've got. You've got to follow the results.
Right.
So all of that stuff we tested, the first test sucked. It all had to come out.
Right. I get it. So I want to leave you this because we're going to end this week.
We got to end.
And then we're going to go on next week. But I want to leave you with this. There was a time, I can't remember when I had this discussion with Kevin, but there was a time when our good friends, Toad the Wet Sprocket, Steve Tipp, basically turned me onto this band. I went to see them play the Bacchanal, right? The old Bacchanal.
Right.
And I go in, I watch the thing, and they did a pretty good set. Nice guys. Santa Barbara's packed because of all the people from Santa Barbara that went to school at San Diego State at the time, or, you know, USD or UCSD or whatever it was. And they finished their set, and they came back out to do an encore. And this was back in the days where you had to kind of sit down on the floor at the Bacchanal. They wouldn't let people stand up and dance. And they came out, and they did a Redemption song by Bob Marley. And everybody was singing along with it. And I went back in, like, on the Monday or whatever it was, and I said to Kevin, I go, I think we should, because we played some Marley, some. Not a lot, but we played some. And I said to Kevin, I think we should test Redemption song. In fact, we should test everything on Legend. And we did at one point, and all of it came back huge. And the one thing that we noticed was the sales chart in San Diego. Whether you wanted to or not, Legend charted every single week along with Dark Side of the Moon. And we knew at that point there was I call it the Catcher in the Rye thing, where everybody at one point in their life has to get a Catcher in the Rye, a copy of Catcher in the Rye, they get a copy of Legend, and they get a copy of the first Violent Femmes album, and that's pretty much the passage into college from high school. Okay. And it still happens today.
And what's your point?
So my point is that if you pay attention to what's selling, more so than 100 people in a room that's telling you what works and what doesn't work. Because you got to remember, there's a lot of people out there that are never going to, like the...
Oh my God, was this whole diatribe just about to tell me how irrelevant research is?
Yeah, research, not about how irrelevant it is, how basically...
It's a tool. Here's the problem. Everybody forgets exactly, that it's just another tool.
It's not necessarily...
It's not the be-all and end-all.
It's not necessarily the hammer that you need to fix the little tiny watch that you're programming.
Oh God, here we go.
We'll leave you with that, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm glad it's over for this week. Goodbye!
Max Tolkoff, Michael Halloran, I don't know why we're doing this thing. It's two old men yelling about radio. Say goodbye, Max.
Goodbye, Max.
No, say goodbye on the microphone.
Goodbye, Max.
Thanks to Fred Jacobs for putting us together.
No.
Slam the door.